Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Another company that's definitely in the crosshairs, TikTok, and the company's CEO up on Capitol Hill today to lobby against a bill that would force the app's Chinese parent to sell it or face a ban here in the United States.
This is TikTok intends to exhaust all legal challenges before it considers any kind of divestiture from Chinese parent company ByteDance. If the latest U.S. legislation targeting the app becomes law, that's according to people familiar with the matter. Weighing in on this yesterday, on Balance of Power, Democratic representative from Massachusetts, Seth Moulton.
I think that we don't need the Chinese Communist Party telling our kids what to watch online, which is essentially what's going on here. And I just want to see TikTok survive and thrive, but under American protections, in American hands. And everyone, I think, here in America should want that, too.
All right. That's Democratic Representative from Massachusetts, Seth Moulton, joining Balance of Power yesterday. Well, following all of this for us is our own Bloomberg News technology reporter, Alex Barinka. She's joining us from L.A. Alex, pretty heated issue. And it's funny. It's tricky. I don't know. How do you think about it from somebody who follows the tech sector and the tech companies here in the United States and how it's different for a company that has a Chinese parent company?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that Chinese parentage is the big difference here for TikTok. Obviously, we've seen scrutiny of the likes of Meta or X, formerly Twitter, but they have not been kind of caught up in this U.S.-China debate the same way TikTok has. Now, how do I see this bill? Well, this has been an ongoing process for TikTok. This is not the first bill that's been introduced, but if this bill does pass the House vote tomorrow morning, then it will be the furthest bill that we've seen to legislate TikTok. So there's quite a bit of momentum. It was introduced just a few days ago, and we're already moving really quickly to see a House vote, but it's not the end of the story. We still don't have a co-sponsor for a matching process in the Senate, which if you followed any of the legislation in DC, you know it's where a lot of House introduced votes go to die. So certainly it'll continue to be kind of a dramatic flurry of events, not only over the next 24 hours until we see this vote on the House floor tomorrow, but also in the intervening weeks if the House does push this through and vote in favor for this bill.
Okay, I just want to take a step back and move away from Washington for a second, Alex, and talk more about TikTok as a product and what exactly is at issue here. Because there have been complaints about the TikTok algorithm, what it shows, especially to young kids around the world, but mostly here in the United States who use the app. What has your reporting told you about the TikTok algorithm and what kids in the US see versus kids maybe in China see when they use the app?
Now, in the U.S., kids as young as 13 are able to log on to the app. Places like China have a higher age gating.
That's
remind you that TikTok is not actually in China. Douyin, TikTok's sister app under the ByteDance parent umbrella, is the Chinese app. So you do have different age constraints, but you know, companies would say that's on the government to actually put those regulations in place, like it is in other countries. Now, you mentioned the TikTok algorithm. It is so good and so uncanny canny at knowing your interests, that it's actually been kind of the thing that's raised some red flags for lawmakers. TikTok's algorithm, based on what you watch, how long you watch it, what you comment on or share or like, kind of decides what you might be interested in. The vast majority of the concerns when we talk to experts are around that data collection. What could happen with that data? Could a country like China, because TikTok's parent company ByteDance is a Chinese company, could the Chinese government request from ByteDance information on US users? Could the Chinese government somehow influence TikTok's feed, what those young vulnerable children are seeing, or adults, because there's now 170 million Americans on the app, it's not just kids anymore. So that tends to be kind of the generalized concern that is unique to TikTok. Of course, TikTok has said that they do not share any information with China. The CEO testified last year that they're not an agent of the Chinese government, and they spent upwards of $1.5 billion to kind of protect US data on servers that are overseen by Oracle, an American company. So that is kind of the back and forth that TikTok is sandwiched in between.
Isn't it also, though, I mean, you know, to be fair, I mean, China also, in terms of US companies in China operating social media, they're also banned and blocked or have pulled out for like different reasons. But I feel like there's a little bit of the same thing that has gone on over there.
Certainly. Folks who've been watching the showdown kind of say what the U.S. government is looking to do with TikTok looks a lot more than what we see in China. Facebook hasn't been in that country since 2009. It is akin to, you know, the kind of information control that we see in China. And that's also, frankly, center to TikTok's argument. They've argued consistently that the U.S. Constitution in one way or another should protect the flow of free speech, including on their platform. So, yes, it's certainly does seem like some lawmakers are taking some cues from the pseudo-techno-nationalism that we see in countries like China, which are much more gated for homegrown technologies.
What's also interesting now is President Trump, former President Trump, kind of changing his tune on the way that he thinks about a potential ban of TikTok. Remember, this was first raised during his administration. There was that whole thing during 2020 with the idea of another US, a US company coming in and buying the US assets of TikTok. Obviously, that didn't happen. But now he's out there saying, Alex, that he doesn't want to ban TikTok because then it would make Facebook bigger. But would that actually happen if TikTok is divested from ByteDance and a US company holds on to it?
It's a stunning TikTok, a stunning flip-flop, I must say, from Trump, who, as you mentioned, was the first to sign an executive order in 2020 to ban this app. Trump might be a little bit upset still because Facebook did kick him off the platform after the January 6, 2021 insurrection. They allowed him back on 2 years later, but maybe he's still a little bit salty. That being said, the way this bill, the language in this bill is laid out, they want a divestiture, a separation from ByteDance. In theory, that would mean a U.S. company or another kind of cohort of shareholders might own the app and it would continue to exist. In practice, TikTok, among others, say that that's impossible. Lina Khan's FTC would never allow an antitrust, this to sail through antitrust if there is one of the few big tech buyers who could actually write the check for TikTok. So they say, look, this is inherently a ban.
Why don't they just spin it off? Couldn't they just spin it off and make it a public company?
They could. The problem is we don't know if that will satiate lawmakers' concerns.
Okay.
So when you think about the options, as a former deals reporter like I am, that would certainly be one that comes to mind. But lawmakers are not laying out specifically what exact structure would make them happy if ByteDance were to divest this, which our sources tell us ByteDance sees a divestiture or sale as the absolute last resort.
Anything we know on why the former president, Donald Trump, has flip-flopped?
It might be to kind of encourage his base to pay attention. He did talk a little bit about how teens would riot, how there are so many young people on the app. It has, though, put Republicans, who have largely been the driving force between the anti-TikTok and anti-China sentiment, it's put them in kind of an awkward position. So even as this drama is not only a little bit awkward between US and China, within the party, you're seeing a little bit of awkwardness as folks folks like Republican Senator Tom Tillis have come out and said in the last 24 hours that he's concerned that this bill might set a weird precedent, particularly for other tech companies that are not domiciled here in America.
Hey, Alex, we should note that I know that the Biden campaign is on TikTok and uses TikTok.
Oh, just recently, right?
Just recently. Is the Trump campaign on TikTok, though?
I have not seen the Trump campaign on TikTok. Biden is there doing the memes, doing the internet vernacular thing.
Anything to reach the youths, right?
Exactly. They posted about 36 videos of things like him recoiling with eyes wide from Marjorie Taylor Greene ahead of the State of the Union with some kind of internet insider joke. So the Biden's administration is there, even though he said that he would sign this bill if it does fly through Senate and the House and gets proposed to him as a law.
All right. If you can squeeze this in 30 seconds, anything that we're hearing about former President Donald Trump talking to Elon Musk about potentially buying Truth Social, just got to be quick here. Are we hearing anything?
We are seeing the news reports. We're watching it closely. I think when it comes to people talking a big game in the social media world and the politics world, you've got all the right factors on this front. We'll see. That seems to be Trump's favorite place. Elon does seem to be favoring the Republican point of view on his social media platform. I think I would still have some questions for the likes of the FTC and the antitrust regulators whenever these names get thrown around for any of the big tech companies that are facing consumers.
Certainly not a boring world right now. All right, Alex, thank you so much. Bloomberg News technology reporter Alex Borinka joining us out there in LA. Alex, thanks.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
All right, inflation report. I don't know
say
if
that
I can
again.
Say that.
Is that a technical term, Carol?
She's using technical.
It's not a function though on the Bloomberg yet. All right, maybe I shouldn't go that far. Stocks did initially rally though following this morning's inflation report, and while they are off their highs, still in the green. Let's talk about the trading environment. We'll get to Mike McKee in just a moment, but right now let's get to Bloomberg News Markets reporter Abigail Doolittle. Talk to us about the trade off this morning's CPI report to where we are now, Abigail.
Well, it was a little bumpy initially. We did go higher, but then we actually on the equal weighted S&P 500 index went lower. The Russell 2000 went lower. That index, that small cap index, is still down. But the S&P 500 up 0.9%, the NASDAQ up more than 1%. So I would say it's a bit of a relief rally that CPI report, while it did come in a little bit warmer than expected, it wasn't hot, hot, hot. So I think that I think at the end of the day, investors are looking at it in terms of now that there's market voices out there saying that the Fed might not cut at all this year. The fact that last week Fed Chair Jay Powell said, yes, they are cutting this year, and that this CPI report gives them the room to most likely be able to cut this year if other data doesn't come in. So long as they're cutting this year, whether it's the three that they're anticipated to cut or if it turns out to be four or two, I think that that's less important.
Details, right?
Yeah, but just so long as they do. Because when you have somebody like Torsten Slot come out saying that they're not going to cut at all, and I personally could make a case for that as well. Mike McKee here might take exception to that, but I could see how they could make that case given inflation in the 70s, that it is staying stickier. I mean, David Kelly from JP Morgan this morning, the hot cookie analogy, that taking the hot cookies out of the oven.
Yeah, that was great.
It takes them longer to cool. So, and that's the setup for Mike McKee.
Well, Mike, is that true? It does take the hot cookies longer to cool when it comes to inflation. Michael McKee.
You're the baker here. You can tell us.
It does sometimes.
She does. Christmas time, she's crazy with the cookies.
So I've heard.
I'll get back there. It's been really high.
I keep hearing this.
You're wearing leftovers from Christmas cookies.
You know, I've heard this. Carol and I have, been doing this show together for 4 years at this point.
and all I hear is
she makes the best Christmas cookies.
Since we're talking about inflation, input costs have been really high.
There we go.
Labor costs, don't even get me started.
Those sprinkles are ridiculously expensive. It was a good analogy because you could debate. The number came in a little bit higher on the headline rate for on a month over month basis, and it really didn't make a whole lot of difference. But what people are saying is, that would that make it hot? And I think David said, no, it makes it warm. Oh. And the cookies have to cool down when they come right out of the oven. Yeah. The bottom line kind of is this. When you look at what happened, the headline CPI went from 0.305% to 0.442. So you're not talking about even a percentage point change. It looks that way on the Bloomberg, or it comes out as a 0.4 instead of 0.3, but it's a rounding question. So it's not a huge change there that we're seeing. That was largely gasoline, and people knew that, but everybody's been complaining about gas and food. Food was flat. There was no food inflation. So basically, you know, we're not anywhere that tells you we have a real problem. It is a little sticky, as Abigail said, but the Fed expected that. And I think this doesn't change their view one way or another.
But does it, Mike, does it give any credence to the folks who say that last mile, getting inflation down to 2%? Again, I know.
Debunk this? Or is it
and
true?
I don't know, this is CPI, not PCE. Yeah. So the Fed, it's not the Fed's preferred method, but this is an input for PCE.
It is.
But does it add credence to the idea that the last mile is going to be really tough?
I don't know. The last mile is going to take a while, and it's going to be bumpy. How tough it is, we aren't exactly sure yet, because we're just kind of getting to that last mile now. And the issue is, what is it that goes up in price that stays sticky? And this time we saw a number of things that had stuck in the past didn't. And then something like used cars, which had been going down for several months in a row, went up a little bit this month, 0.5%. So is it just going to be bumpy like that? Or is there something that the Fed and its high interest rates can't attack, and it'll take a while for that to come down?
All right, we're going to roll one more name into this conversation. Ira Jersey is also with us, chief U.S. interest rate strategist at Bloomberg Intelligence out there in our BI headquarters in New Jersey. You were on surveillance this morning, breaking it down. So what's of note of your end, and as you listen to this discussion with Abigail and Mike?
Yeah, I think it was interesting just watching what happened with the knee-jerk reaction right after the number, right? Like Mike said, we saw that small beat, we sold off a little bit, and then most of us looked at the data and we're like, yeah, it's kind of like as expected pretty much. And then the market rallied back, and then finally we then sold off again as people kind of, I think, you know, settled into the idea that, look, the numbers came in pretty much as expected, but when you look at what's been turning around, things like used autos and like a lot of actually the goods sector, which had been a drag on CPI for a while, then market participants started to say, like, well, yeah, maybe the Fed's not going to be able to go quite as quickly as we thought. And certainly the market, you know, selling off a little bit today is a reflection of that. And, you know, you see 10-year auction didn't go particularly well about an hour ago. It wasn't bad, but it wasn't a good auction either. So I think market participants are like, okay, let's wait and see now. We have retail sales coming up and then the Fed next week. Let's wait until we hear what Jay Powell has to say before we majorly switch our positions and thinking.
I was going to say, go ahead,
here's why it matters to the Fed coming up, because they have the meeting on March 20th. They've already told us they're not going to do anything, but we do get a new set of economic projections and a new dot plot. So the market's trying to game out whether they're going to change that or not.
Right.
And my guess is this isn't definitive enough one way or another to lead them to change their forecasts.
I was going to say to Abigail, one group of investors certainly not waiting today is NVIDIA. We promised that we'd get to it. Shares higher by 5% now. So it's over $900 a share. It's not at all-time highs. That would be in the 970s. But still, I mean, it's been an incredible run. Is there anything fundamental about this, or is this all sort of part of the relief rally?
I mean, I think that today it's a little bit of both. I think that it's the relief that the market darling stock can continue to go higher, that the Fed is not going to get in the way of technology overall in terms of the idea that liquidity could stay as tight as it is all year or even tighten more. And this is the favored stock because of AI. Now, one thing I'll point out is, as I'm looking at this stock, out of the 2022 lows, any guesses on how much this stock is up?
2022 lows, 400%?
800.
Oh.
Up 800%. And I can make...
I had to venture a guess.
I can make the case, the technical case, very easily that all of this year's rally from about, let's call it 463 to current levels, could go away like that, just because it's a parabolic uptrend, a 90-degree angle can't hold. And the RSI, which we talk about sometimes, it is actually just on the line of being overbought or oversold, which means that the momentum is not as good. So people are a little bit nervous here, but they don't want to stop buying. We're going to talk about NVIDIA versus kind of Cisco, kind of
do a little bit of a history lesson with John Authors in a moment. But Ira, I want to go back to you for a moment. In terms of how rates traded off of this morning's report, anything of note there? Because it does seem like we're a little bit higher along the curve.
Yeah, so just about everything. And it's a mix right now between inflation expectations and real yield. So the real yield piece is going to be driven pretty significantly by Federal Reserve expectations. But the fact that you had, I think, the slightly better that, or higher than expected CPI report is one of the reasons why you have break-even rates. So the amount of inflation that the market's expecting has also gone up a couple of three basis points basically across the curve. So in the rates market, you know, we haven't really changed the pricing for the Fed. We're still kind of saying June at July, as a first cut, and then a couple more cuts before year end, actually almost four. I still think that might be too many, and I think that that's one of the big risks that still needs to get priced out of the market is what happens, to Mike McKee's point, what happens if you just have two members of the Federal Reserve move from the median of the dots up just one, taking out one more cut, mm-hmm. and in doing so, you can wind up seeing a pretty big sell-off in the front end of the curve because that could change some of the dynamics. It's hard to say that one cut is going to move the market a lot, but the fact is that these days it really is moving the market, you know, 25 basis points every time you get, you know, one or two dots moving significantly.
All right, Mike, the ball's in your court.
Well, it's funny because we've talked about this quite a bit, that the market is always adjusting, you know, minute by minute, day by day.
And does some of the Fed's work for it, right, sometimes?
Yeah, to a certain extent. Yes, I mean, that's the idea of monetary policy feeds through the financial markets. But the Fed only updates once every quarter. And so the Fed is always going to be, quote unquote, behind where the market is. But the question that the market has to divine is what they're looking at right now, the bright, shiny object in front of them right now, enough for the Fed to make a forecast that will last out a quarter? And that's the harder thing for them, which is why I think they don't change significantly unless somebody had already changed. I don't think this number makes a difference.
I think what's still fascinating to me, Carol, is that even after the summary of economic projections in December, which called for a median of three, you had people pricing in six rate cuts.
It was so aggressive at the end of last year.
It took weeks for that to get down to even close to three.
Yeah, a real reset.
To match what the Fed is seeing.
One thing, you know, I want to roll into this, because we were talking about this in the newsroom, and this comes from you, Ira. You were on surveillance this morning, and you talked about, you know, it's something we've talked about certainly with Abigail and others and market guests about kind of all of the money on the sidelines when it comes to the markets. And I feel like we've got the perfect roundtable to kind of address that. What are you actually seeing and what that means? Do we have it all wrong that this money is just going to kind of at some point come into either stocks or bonds?
So if you look at cash on the sidelines, meaning both bank deposits, retail bank deposits, as well as retail money market fund balances, it's basically at the average of what it has been for the last, you know, 30 years in terms of a share of financial net worth. So it's not obvious to us that that is cash on the sidelines that needs to go into other financial markets. In fact, we think that it probably is not. And when you look at a bulk of the change, so two things have been moving the money market mutual fund inflows. Number one was out of bank deposits starting last March when you had the SVB blow up, a lot of deposits left to go to money funds. And in particular, because money market funds yield, you know, three times what the average bank deposit does. So why not moved into there? And then you've seen new money. So the new savings that is going on, and just from the personal income and spending report that, you know, Mike McKee talks about at the end of every month when we get the PC data, as that money comes in, instead of going into bank deposits, it's now going into money funds for the same reason. Money funds yield 5%, bank deposits yield 1%. It's a no-brainer. That's just where savings is going, not necessarily going to find its way into the stock market or the bond market or anywhere else.
I see Abigail nodding here because this is a question we've been asking for months at this point. What happens to this $5-6 trillion that is in money market funds when rates do start to go down? Where does it go? And Ira writes in a great note that, hey, it might not actually go into the market.
Yeah, I think it's a really compelling case that it may not indeed go into the market for the very reason that if you can get 4 or 5% by just putting it in money markets, why is it going to come out? Now, when rates go down, There will be some savvy, smart investors that will quickly redeploy it in other ways. Will it necessarily go into stocks? We don't know that. Maybe it goes into fixed income of some sort as rates come in. But a lot of people, they won't adjust it for a while, you know, just creatures of habit. The difference between 5% and 3%, I think it would take a significant drop for people to take the money out. And then if rates are coming in that much, at that point, is there a haven bid to bonds? Is there a reason that folks would even want to put it into stocks? I don't know. I think that Ira makes a very compelling case around that.
Well, this whole idea that household cash is not above typical levels, as he says, the cash holdings as a share of financial assets are right in the range that's persisted for the past two generations. Mike, so the Fed component to this, I'm sure the Fed is looking at all of these kinds of data points.
Yeah, the Fed obviously looks at asset prices as part of their guesstimation of where inflation is. It's not an official part of it, but they try to figure out if we're seeing inflation there that could be a problem. And then they're always watching for bubbles. They won't mm-hmm. step in front of them, but they want to know what's happening with the markets. But at this point, the idea of whether you're buying treasury bills or whether you're buying stocks, it's no concern of theirs.
And something interesting, just to jump in here for a moment, if you were to compare the yield on the S&P 500 when adjusted for inflation, it's 0.89%, so it's not even 1%. Mm-hmm. So there's a big spread there. I think it really helps.
Well, of course,
make
if I have
case.
Only the S&P NVIDIA.
Yes, that's true. then you want
well.
It on stocks.
All right, round robin. Iro, next focal point for you, really quickly, 2 seconds.
Well, it's tomorrow's retail sales report, because if the consumer is still very robust, it's hard to see the Fed needing to cut very early.
Mike, a second.
Well, I'm going to go with the retail sales report and the PPI that's coming, because then we get the PCE. We can derive the PCE.
I'm looking a little bit further out to next week in the Fed.
Got it. You guys rock. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Well, another day and another batch of Boeing stories and headlines, and another day with Boeing shares trading lower. They are down about 4.4%. They lost 3% on Monday, and they lost about 2.25% on Friday. Today's stories, Tim, let's just go through them. There's an FAA audit of the production of Boeing 737 MAX. It found dozens of failures in the manufacturing process. This is a story out from the New York Times.
Also today, a Boeing whistleblower who raised safety concerns was found dead. And Carol, meantime, Boeing deliveries trail Airbus as the 737 MAX crisis slows factories.
And then there's fallout that kind of spreads. You've got Southwest falling the most in 4 years on those Boeing woes. There's more. So let's get to it. The latest on Boeing and its impact. Let's get to our interview. Back with us is Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Aerospace Defense and Airlines Analyst George Ferguson in our BI headquarters in Princeton. George, I'm not quite sure where to start, although I do feel like the New York Times story is front and center, but you're the expert. What is top of mind when you're thinking about the Boeing story again on this Tuesday, March 12th?
So I think the New York Times story was probably the most interesting piece of new news that came out in the last couple of days. I think we knew Boeing was going to have problems with the manufacturing process. We knew they probably weren't going to pass this. But I think where they honed in on Spirit Aerosystems, what we saw is that more of those inspections came up bad than came up good at Spirit. And I think that kind of dovetails with the news we saw, I think it was about a week and a half ago, about Boeing exploring the purchase and reintegration of Spirit Aerosystems. My guess is that Boeing probably saw the early version of this report. They've been looking at potentially bringing Spirit in-house anyways. This probably just cemented it. It does reinforce in my mind as an analyst that the path to higher quality and higher builds on the Boeing MAX really flows through Spirit Aerosystems, and Boeing buying it and integrating it is probably going to be the only way they can really control things well enough to feel really happy about, about the quality and about the number of airplanes they can get out the door.
I also want to bring in with us Sheila Kayaglu, Equity Research Managing Director and Aerospace and Defense and Airlines Analyst at Jefferies. She joins us on the phone from New York City. Sheila, given all the problems that Boeing has had just in the last few months, And even though management is now going to look to tie compensation more towards safety than it has in the past, is this a company you're confident in that can recover fully from its past?
Sure. Thank you for having me. So I think Boeing, you know, obviously deliveries have been disappointing in January, as well as the February report that was just released at 11 a.m. today. However, I do think Boeing is one of the greatest manufacturers globally and obviously one of the largest in the U.S. So super critical to the U.S. economy, the airline industry, as well as all the employees and suppliers it touches. But clearly they're going through a tough time, and the headlines over the past week read pretty negatively and like a drama. So I do think that there has to be some changes made, clearly not in the compensation because, you know, safety is a part of every culture and should be, but maybe, you know, what the NTSB asked for last week was potentially more documentation, more oversight on these processes. But you would think the MAX line was one of the most scrutinized production lines in the world, manufacturing lines, just given the incidents it had over the past 5 years.
Sheila, so critical that you think the U.S. government could come in and offer some sort of bailout or fix for the company? Oversight?
So I don't think we're in the position of a bailout, right? Boeing is a very generally healthy company. It'll probably generate $4 billion of cash flow on the low end this year. Deliveries on the MAX are coming in lower, but to put it in perspective, we thought they would do 500 deliveries. Maybe the delivery number is going to be 400 this year, so 20% lower. So it's not necessarily like, it's not in any point of view a bailout, but things are 20% lower than expected, and we continue to hear delays. And that's resulting in certification process delays with their new aircraft, like the MAX 7, like the MAX 10. So I don't think Boeing's in the position of a bailout. However, it does need to fix its manufacturing processes to get the deliveries to the 38 a month that they should be at in the first half of this year.
George, I want to bring you back in. We've talked with you, Tim and I, a lot over the last few weeks when it comes to Boeing. And I'm hearing there's tough times and then there's tough times when I hear bailout and I hear Sheila saying, no, that this is not likely. How do you describe the situation at Boeing right now? Is it just a tough time or something more serious in terms of figuring out, you know, what's going on internally at this company and getting it under control?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a, it's a function of decades of focusing on trying to outsource more of the, you know, the build of an airplane and not focusing on the fundamentals. And so, unfortunately, I think, you know, David Calhoun becomes the caretaker of putting it back together. But I think, you know, this is sort of Boeing's time where they have to focus more on engineering, focus more on manufacturing, focus less on getting the last penny out of every supplier. And squeezing the process, this is a time where they've got to drop back to fundamentals. And so I think, again, it makes it a particularly difficult time. But I do think they're, you know, they'll turn it around here, and hopefully there'll be a stronger company for it that focuses on, again, the fundamentals of engineering and manufacturing.
George, do they turn it around soon enough? I mean, there's another story by Mary Schlangenstein today about United telling Boeing to stop building the 737 MAX 10 jets for the carrier, opting to switch to a smaller variant and the rival Airbus SE A321 until Boeing can pull the stretched single aisle through its long-delayed certification. I do feel like there's stuff coming from the airline space, and I wonder how much pressure that's putting on Boeing, and is Boeing really at risk at losing some of these guys as future customers?
United is a case in point where Boeing would really not want to lose that customer. And even despite the fact that there's only two manufacturers and the backlog is even much larger at Airbus,
right,
where I think he probably couldn't get airplanes until, you know, late this decade, early next, Kirby's looking for a way to get those longer airplanes sooner rather than later, sort of given up on Boeing's ability to get the Dash 10 certified in the near term. He's probably very, very frustrated because all the airlines, especially in the U.S. but around the globe, are moving to larger aircraft because of those higher pilot salaries they gave away. Those larger aircraft drop the cost per seat mile, and that's what's going to keep him competitive. So you can sense his frustration that he can't get his hands on that really important airplane to his business, mm-hmm. and that's where you start to run the risk of losing customers. They haven't yet, but it's a real risk.
Sheila, what about when it comes to Southwest? Shares of Southwest down almost 15% as we speak because the company's planning to cut capacity this year, halt most of its hiring, review its spending plans in response to reduced aircraft deliveries from Boeing. This is a company that's exclusively reliant on 737s and Boeing aircraft. Does it make these companies think differently about perhaps changing up their fleets? I know that's a very, very big deal because it involves pilots, it involves maintenance, and it's a huge deal, but does it make them think differently?
Sure. So, you know, covering Southwest, we do have an underperform rating on the name. So down 14%, you know, I think this is what we expected for two reasons. First, they're cutting their MAX guidance, which was somewhat expected given where what they anticipated for the year was quite high. So they're trimming from 79 MAX deliveries in 2024 to 46, a 30-point cut, which results in a one-point cut to their 2024 capacity expectations, previously up 6% year-over-year. Second, which is why Love is down, is they had an overzealous expectation for pricing. They were one of the only airlines that expected pricing up about mid-single digits year-over-year versus American R buy rating that had expected domestic pricing down low single digits year-over-year for 2024. So it cut back its Q1 pricing guide, and it expects it now to be flat to up 2% from, it cut it to be down low single digits now. So that's why I think Southwest is underperforming, not only because of its Boeing woes, but because of its pricing expectations that it set out there, which were over aggressive.
Hey, one last question, if we can get a response from both of you. I don't want to sound like a tabloid, but it's on the Bloomberg. We wrote about it. A Boeing whistleblower who raised some safety concerns about the plane makers, Boeing's production standards at the North Charleston 787 Dreamliner factory has been found dead. He's given evidence in a lawsuit against Boeing. He was supposed to go some further questioning on Saturday, and then he didn't appear, and they found him. George, I don't know. Is it just another headline in kind of a rough year for Boeing? How do you read this? Just got about 30 seconds.
Yeah, I don't know that. I can't read much into that. I don't think there's any foul play. And I'm an analyst more than a criminal investigator.
Fair enough. Sheila, any thoughts on that? 20 seconds for you.
I mean, you can't make it up with the New York Times audit saying that Spirit workers used hotel keys to check door seals, liquid soap as lubricants. It seems like the headlines are just not pleasant. So I can't comment on that criminal item, or that investigation. But it seems like the headlines are not great.
Just a bad year, to say the least. All right, Boeing shares down about 4.5%. Hey guys, thank you so much. So appreciate it. Bloomberg Intelligence senior aerospace, defense, and airlines analyst George Ferguson on our BI offices in Princeton, and Sheila Kayalaglu, equity research managing director, aerospace and defense, and airlines analyst at Jefferies, joining us on the phone in New York City. Guys, thank you so much.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
So we're talking about the economy here in the U.S., but we want to talk about another economy, and that has to do with that of Ireland.
Yeah, Ireland's final GDP fell 3.4% quarter over quarter in the fourth quarter of the year. That's according to data earlier this month from the Central Statistics Office of Ireland. That said, Carol, as you reminded me earlier, GDP not generally considered a good indicator of the Irish economy because it can be distorted by the large number of international companies that operate there, which have been impacted by rising inflation and high interest rates.
All right. So for a pulse on what's happening in Ireland, we welcome Michael Lohan. He's CEO of IDA Ireland. It's the country's foreign direct investment agency responsible for attracting business investment in the country as we get ready for St. Paddy's Day just around the corner. I'm like, oh, wait, what time of year is it? How are you?
I'm very good, Carol. Nice to meet you and Tim and happy St. Patrick's week.
Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. Nice to meet you. We've been talking to your teams at IDA for many, many years. Tell us about the economy that you're seeing and how you are seeing things more broadly, because you guys have a great intersection of that.
We do, and it's interesting from your last segment into this segment, you know, there's a lot of comparables there as well at the European economy. But maybe if I speak to Ireland first, you know, you're correct. The Irish economy has been fueled by innovation, by enterprise, and particularly by foreign direct investment. And what has that meant to us? It's meant that, you know, the fundamentals of our economy are very strong. Like, our demographics are strong. We have the youngest population in Europe, the most educated population in Europe. Our financial position as an economy, you know, we had a surplus at the end of the year. And when you put that against the backdrop, you know, of the, the incentives that the government had to bring into inflation, you know, and trying to counteract inflation element, to still come out at the end of last year with a positive net surplus in the Irish economy puts us in a strong position. And the third area we're very confident is that we have a very diversified economy in Ireland. Yes, we have FDI, but we also have a very strong indigenous base. We have a very strong food, agribusiness, and we have future areas of growth as well. So we see a real potential for the Irish economy going forward.
Talk to me about employment in the country. Are companies able to find enough employees there?
Yeah, so in the employment level, we're almost at what you'd classify as full employment. But where Ireland is actually, and this is really, I suppose, the difference in the Irish economy to many others, is we're an open economy where we actually attract a lot of talent in.
Meaning immigrants.
So we are, at this point, in the last decade, the Irish economy has grown by 10%. You know, so that's by percentage scale, it's we're outscaling any other economy in the world. So actually, our population is growing. Our opportunity for that population is also growing. So we're attracting both, I suppose, inward talent into our country from all over the world.
Well, I was going to ask, where's that talent coming from?
Well, of course, within Europe, you have free movement. So, you know, you have 500 million people in Europe, 300 million of those are working age, if you put it in that context. So they actually have free access into Ireland. But if you go beyond the European Union, we actually have set up what we call critical skills. So we identify critical skills. If you're in the technology industry, for example, you are fast-tracked in terms of access to Ireland. So therefore, it means that you can come to Ireland, get a career, and start to build your life in Ireland in that context. It has been really successful. That, you know, we have, as I look at the cohort of companies that we have in our FDI portfolio, typically those sites have 30, 40, 50 different nationalities within their campus. So right. The diversity of that workforce is incredible. And not only from an economic perspective, from a social perspective as well, it's transformed.
What has changed? I mean, the multinational dominance and the importance that is certainly to the Ireland economy, I mean, not a new story. But I am curious, with the pushback against globalization, pressure on the developed world to have more companies keeping business at home, what's changed dynamically in the last, I don't know, what's the right timeline? Have things changed in the last 5 years, 3 years, 2 years?
So I think there is change, and I think there's always been change, but we've probably seen an acceleration of that, especially
acceleration post-COVID. Of people coming in or some movement coming out?
We've seen an acceleration of industrial policy across the globe. So if you think about, you know, the IRA Act here in the US, right. And we think about the response in Europe with the European Chips Act. So the industrial landscape has certainly changed, particularly in the last 24 months.
Is it slowing foreign direct investment or investment in Ireland?
Well, funnily, it's not. And I'll tell you, and from my experience, why it's not slowing it is that companies still need to look for growth. They need to look for innovation, and they need to look for locations which are proven and stable. And fortunately, in Ireland, we have that pro-enterprise, we're committed, and you know exactly what you're going to get in Ireland. You're going to get full commitment from the government. You're going to be able to attract the talent you need to enable to bring your technology or indeed your product or service to market. And so we're seeing actually, you know, as companies look to grow their market share, Ireland is seen as a safe location, a proven location in which to do that.
Is it existing companies growing or is it new coming in? Give me an idea.
It's both. So maybe the best way to put it in context is last year, we actually announced 248 distinct investments that we would have supported or enabled through IDA. That's an increase on the previous year. And we've now come off 12 years of incremental growth year on year. So every year we've actually beaten the record before, and last year we done the same. And of the 248 investments, 83 of them were what we classify as first-time new name investments into Ireland. And they come across sectors which are life sciences, international financial services, and indeed technology. So we get that spread across those sectors.
Michael, I don't know if you know this, but 2024 in the US is an election year.
Yeah.
We have an election
this morning about that.
Okay, yeah. So that's happening, breaking news. What's the conversation happening at IDA Ireland right now about the outcome of the presidential election? Does it matter to you?
I think this year is an amazing year when you think about across the globe, the number of elections that are happening.
I was going to say globally, right?
Globally, yeah, exactly. None more so maybe to importance than here in the US. So what's our conversation? I think we're looking with interest as to which way the because, let's be honest, the US economy, you know, has very much, it's a bellwether for the global economy. It certainly is very important from the Irish economy perspective.
And has been a standout, to be fair, among the developed world.
Absolutely, absolutely. But remember this as well, like this year, actually in September of this year, Ireland and the US celebrate their 100 years of trade and of, as well. We are 75 years in existence this year. And over all of those 75 years, or indeed 100, we've worked with every administration in the US. We've had this close relationship. I expect that to continue. Yes, there will be probably some challenges along the road, but you know, we've faced challenges before.
When it comes to the multinationals in there, is the US making up the largest component? And is that also the largest component of new business or new investment that comes in, or no?
Yes. Yeah, so if you look at our 1,800 client companies in IDA, 950 of them would be US companies.
So about half.
About half. And our business, and if we look at the 300,000 people that's employed in FDI in Ireland, 200,000 of those are actually related to US companies. So
they're the bigger employers.
They're a bigger employer, correct. And if we look across our global business, on a yearly basis, it roughly spans 60-odd% from the US, 20-25% from Europe, and the rest from the balance from around the world. So that's typically our yearly profile in terms of investment.
New investment though, Asia, China, or the Middle East, is there anything that's kind of a new trend?
Yeah, so what we see actually in Asia, we actually see quite a lot of interest in Europe. We see quite a lot of interest in Ireland as a beachhead for Asian companies.
Is it China or Asian companies?
Well, it's both. So, like, you know, in terms of China, in Japan, we have a long relationship with Japan as well. So if we look at our portfolio of companies from what we call our Asia-Pac region, it's roughly about 150 companies that we would have supported or be in partnership with in Ireland.
Where have you seen the most pullback in investment from just recently?
Pullback, obviously we've gone through a significant challenge in technology. So in essence, there has been a step back and a pullback in the technology sector. But as I say, that has been, if we look at our numbers from last year, counteracted with the growth in life sciences and financial services.
What about a region of the world?
Region in the world, Europe actually stronger last year. Europe last year was stronger for us than it was in a decade. The US was marginally down, but I'm speaking margins, degrees of margins in that regard.
The technology pullback because of the pressure on those big tech companies to kind of bring business back home, is that why?
Technology reset last year, I think, caused decision-making to slow. And I think ultimately we saw that in our numbers as well over the course of 2023.
Great stuff. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, happy St. Paddy's Day. St. Paddy's Week.
I guess it's a week now.
It used to be. Yeah, it's officially a week.
Okay.
Michael Lowen, Chief Executive Officer at IDA Ireland, joining us in studio. Thank you.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.